Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado, and we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. I hope your week's going well. I hope that maybe you didn't have to work on Monday. I know here in the States, Monday was Martin Luther King Day. Hopefully, you were able to take that Monday off. Always a little bit nicer week when you get to start on a Tuesday instead of that dreaded Monday. But I hope your week is going well. Hope you and your family and friends are staying strong and healthy right now. You know, we did our NFL playoff preview last week here on The Dose. And we kind of talked about how we were hoping to have some good games in these playoffs. Some fun games, some tight games, some competitive games. Well, out of the six games played over wild card weekend, four of them came down to the final possession. So yeah, we had some pretty decent games. In the first game of the weekend, the Seattle Seahawks gave the San Francisco 49ers all they wanted. Well, for about 37 minutes. Unfortunately, NFL games last 60 minutes, and after they had taken a 17-16 lead at halftime, the Niners then rolled off 25 points and blew out Seattle 41-23. Hey, San Fran looked very strong. We will see how long rookie quarterback Brock Purdy can keep playing beyond his years, but he looked good on Saturday. The Buffalo Bills faced their division rival Miami Dolphins on Sunday, and after they jumped out to a 17-0 lead, Bills quarterback Josh Allen, I don't know, he decided like to get cute, turn the ball over a few times, and the Bills had to hold on for dear life. They scraped past the Miami Dolphins 34-31. It was a similar scene in Cincinnati, where the Bengals were absolutely going to lose in the wild card round. Hey, that game was over. The Baltimore Ravens win to Cincinnati, and with just 3 minutes left to play, the game's tied at 17. The Ravens are about to score. They're at the Cincinnati 2-yard line. Hey, worst case, they're going to kick a field goal and win this thing. And then backup quarterback Tyler Huntley fumbled, trying to dive into the end zone. Bengals defensive lineman Sam Hubbard returned that fumble 98 yards for the game winner. And I know there's a lot of talk. Hey, if Lamar Jackson had been playing, that wouldn't happen. Yeah. And if grandma had, you know, a few other things, she'd be grandpa. That's not who was playing. It doesn't matter. Did Cincinnati get away with a clip on that touchdown return? Yeah, probably. But, you know, the refs, they didn't have a great weekend. The NFL was entertaining. The refs probably didn't have a great weekend, though. The Bengals squeaked by the Ravens 24-17. You know, we said last week on the preview that both the Minnesota Vikings and the New York Giants had played close games all year. We expected another one between those two teams on Sunday, and we got it. Giants quarterback Daniel Jones threw for 300 yards. He ran for another 80, and Vikings quarterback Kirk Cousins was, well, he was Kirk Cousins. The Giants beat the Vikings 31-24. They advance. The most insane game of the weekend took place in Jacksonville on Saturday night, where Jaguars quarterback Trevor Lawrence threw four interceptions, and the Los Angeles Chargers jumped out to a 27-0 lead. But you know the Schottenheimer curse is real, and it rose up, and it bit that dreadful franchise once again. The Chargers could do no right in the second half. The Jaguars could do no wrong in the second half. The Jacksonville Jaguars come back from down 27 and beat the Chargers 31-27. After the game over the weekend, the Chargers fired their offensive coordinator and their quarterback coach, but they spared head coach Brandon Staley. For which, as a Bronco fan, I could not have been happier. Staley forever. He's an idiot. Keep him as long as you can. We finished wild card weekend, well, with a snoozer. The Dallas Cowboys made Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers look awful. And they kind of made Brady look like he should have retired a long time ago. They thumped the Bucs 31-14. But bizarrely, the Dallas Cowboys place kicker, Brett Maier, missed a number of extra points after touchdowns. how many extra points did he miss?
Not two, not three, not four, not five.
Calm down, LeBron. It was four. You always get so excited, LeBron. Just chill, bro. Why you always get so emotional? Everything you do, you're always putting on a show. Just calm down. So now, this weekend, we have the divisional round of the NFL playoffs in the AFC on Saturday. We will have those surprising Jacksonville Jaguars headed to Arrowhead to face the Kansas City Chiefs. Now, the Chiefs already beat the Jags 27-17 earlier in the season. I'll be honest, I hope they can even keep it that close here, but I kind of doubt it. On the NFC side, Saturday night, the New York Giants go to Philadelphia to face the Eagles. The Giants have lost to the Eagles twice this year, but I could see them keeping it close maybe for a while, maybe battling a little bit. I just don't see any way they could beat the Eagles. I think the Eagles have too much on both sides of the ball. So we move to Sunday, where we have the Cincinnati Bengals going to Buffalo to have that rematch with the Bills. Remember where DeMar Hamlin was injured, and they ended up canceling that game in Cincinnati. Now, I know both the Bills and the Bengals kind of scraped past their wild card opponents. So now there's doubt about both teams. Hey, both these teams look gettable. Remember this. I really believe both of those teams were probably on a little bit of DeMar Hamlin hangover after all that had happened. And remember, in the wild card round, they were both facing division rivals. You know your rivals so well. So, I mean, maybe you're a little flat. The other team knows everything you're going to do. I think they had to grind out some ugly wins, but I still think either one of these teams are more than capable of not just going to, but winning the Super Bowl. I'll take Buffalo in a close one because they're at home. I think this might be a really fun game, though. Finally, on Sunday afternoon this coming weekend, we get those Dallas Cowboys going to the Bay Area to face the San Francisco 49ers. And you know, the Cowboys have to be feeling great about themselves. They finally win a playoff game, and they end Tom Brady's season. You got to feel pretty good. Go out there and light up that Tampa defense. Unfortunately, that might be fool's gold. Because watching that game on Monday night, the Buccaneers were really bad. And the Cowboys are about to face what could be one of the most dangerous teams in the NFL this year. I do not like Dallas here at all. I think the Niners roll. But hey, Dallas, as you say every year, just wait till next year. Hey, before we jump in today, just want to remind you, be sure you stop by DailyDoseSports.com every single week where you can find articles that I'm putting up every week. You can find a link to the podcast. You can find a link to the video. You can find a ton of information over there. Plus, if you need some Daily Dose gear, you can always go there and find links to it. We've got t-shirts. We've got sweatshirts. We've got hoodies. Whatever you might need is over at DailyDoseSports.com, so make sure you're stopping by. Hey, today on the show, we are going to be joined by a guest that we had on recently, and I enjoyed our conversation with him so much, I wanted to have him back, and I wanted to get his thoughts on a few more subjects. If you are a coach, if you are maybe a manager or an athlete, if you are a parent of any of the above, trust me on this. You need to stick around and listen to this interview. It is going to have some very good information on it that you are going to need. In fact, let's get over to our interview with Lee Puvey right now. Joining us today on the Daily Dose, I have a guest that knows sports, he knows coaching, and he's very interested in helping those in positions of leadership. Because Lee Puvey is a former international level coach in track cycling. He has experience in coaching at a number of different degrees, from youth levels all the way to the Olympics, and he is the co-founder of Coach's Soul, a leadership development and coaching company for sports and business coaches. Lee, first off, welcome back to the Daily Dose. We are happy to have you join us again today.
Hey, good to see you, buddy.
Lee, you know, we just had you on just a little bit before the holidays, and we talked a little bit kind of about your business, about Coach's Soul and that kind of thing. And I enjoyed our conversation with you so much. I wanted to have you back. I wanted to pick your brain a little more and discuss a number of subjects. Got a lot of things I want to get to today. First off, Lee, where did you grow up? Because I'm not a smart guy, but I can pick that accent out. I'm almost positive you didn't grow up on the plains of Kansas anywhere.
One of my favorite things to do, and this really irks my wife, is to tease Americans, and particularly to tease them when they say, "Where are you from?"
Right.
So my answer is, "Long Beach, where are you from?" And then they look at me all confused, and I'm like, and then I say, "Okay, guess, where do you think I'm from?" And then they say, "Australia." And then I pretend to be incredibly offended and say, "No, that's where we sent all of our criminals. How dare you say that to me? We cannot be friends." And it irks my wife because that's just my playful nature. And she's like, "You can't be mean to people." I'm like, "Well, I have to go through the world and have some amusement." So no, I'm from Brighton in England. So seaside city directly under London, kind of known as Little London by the Sea. Gay capital of Europe, incredibly vibrant, cosmopolitan, but pretty small, 250,000 odd people, so not a particularly big city.
You know what's funny? You came on last time and you said that you had been involved coaching at your local cycling club in Brighton. We have a Brighton here in Colorado. It is a farm town.
No way.
And, okay. And I had someone reach out to me and say, "That didn't sound like he was from Brighton." That made me laugh harder than anything I've heard recently. So when you were growing up, I'm assuming that is that European model of sports. It's not like a high school sports. It's more like that club kind of sports scene over there. What all sports did you grow up playing or participating in?
The model in the UK has changed tremendously.
Okay.
So, you know, here you have this very kind of high school, college, professional sport model that's been around for quite a while now.
Yeah.
And then more sports are trying to enter that model, but that's the model here. In the UK, almost all sport was amateur. So there's very little money in sport in the UK apart from football, so apart from soccer. Pretty much everything else is amateur, including things like rugby, which is now a professional sport. So when I was young, almost all sport was amateur. British cycling had almost zero funding. So my coach was a national team coach when I first started doing track cycling. I was on the junior national team in GB. He had £1,000 budget for the entire year that basically paid his fuel to go to the tracks and try to find talented riders. That was it. That's his entire budget for the program. So now sport in the UK is incredibly professional because in 1996, there was a lottery created in the UK, and what they decided to do with the profits of the lottery, or well, certainly some of the profits of the lottery, was to put that into arts and sports. And cycling was one of the first sports in the UK to figure this out and what this was going to mean. And they did something called the World Class Performance Programme, and they actually came up with a plan of how they would use the money, and they got the first amount of money from this new lottery-funded programme. Is completely revolutionized sport in the UK. So now sport in the UK for Olympic sports is way more professional than it is in America. Now in America, Olympic sports are more that amateur kind of sport.
Right.
Whereas then you have the professional sports, the college sports, most of which are not Olympic kind of sports. And then to answer your question, I grew up playing a variety of sports. I was a goalie in football, soccer. I ended up being my school rugby captain because I was big and I was fast. So when you're playing schoolboy rugby, that's good. I wasn't big enough and fast enough to be an international rugby player, but I was big enough and fast enough to be a good schoolboy rugby player. I swam for my county, but I'm going to offend every swimmer out there right now. And I've just started swimming again, actually, because I've got an ankle injury, so I can't ride my bike. It's so boring. You swim, you see the tee, you do your tumble turn, you turn around, you come back. And, you know, strategy is an enormous part of sport to me. So then I started doing track cycling because my dad did some cycling. There just by chance happened to be a local track in Brighton that I could ride my bike to and race at. And it's a very strategy-based sport. So I loved that element of it. And I still love that element of it today. It's a very complex sport because of how much drafting affects your ability to win or lose the races. So that then became my main sport, and I did that until a year ago. So I did that for getting on for 40 years.
Wow. You brought up that your dad had done a little bit of cycling. How much involvement, how much impact did your parents have on your athletic career, if any, or maybe not at all?
Yeah, my mom was not at all athletic, but she was my support system. So yeah. The listeners would have heard this, me and you talked about dads before we got onto to the podcast.
Right.
My dad was not a good person. When we're young, we look at our parents like our role models. And my dad would be the role model of an immature man. So he chased women, he had nice cars, he was very outgoing and charismatic, but he was also a narcissist, a liar, and only interested in himself. So for me to get attention from him, being sporty helped, but he never watched me do any sport apart from cycling. The only one he was ever interested in. So swimming for my county, never watched me swim. School rugby captain, didn't watch a game of rugby. So it's not a surprise as a young man, I gravitated towards track cycling because that got my attention from him. So, and that was how I got into it. I started going to watch him race and I was like, you know, as we discussed that thing of beating your dad, I was like, I could do that better than him. So I'm going to do that better than him.
And okay.
That's what happened.
So you end up now, obviously, on that coaching side of things. What impact did your coaches have on you as a younger athlete, or did they?
Oh, they absolutely did. And that's a great question. And it's one I've pondered a lot, you know, with what I do now with kind of emotional leadership coaching, I have to think about like, how did I get here? How do people get to where they get to? And in the work I do with people, we do this thing called essence and survival mechanism. So essence is, what are the qualities you bring as an individual to this world? And they're genetic. Like we're born with genetic predispositions towards psychological qualities. And then the survival mechanism, what's the shields that we put on ourselves to get through our childhoods, to get through our school system, to get through our family systems? And then how does that play out as an adult? And we all have these behaviors. You know, you'll behave differently to other adults. And you think, why do I do this? Or why do I choose to do that? And, you know, through the experience, I look back now and I think about those coaches that I worked with. And I got incredibly lucky with my first coach, a guy called Roy Whitehead, wonderful, older guy, volunteered his time at the local cycle track every Saturday morning. I wouldn't say he was great technically, but what he was he just created this environment where people wanted to come and train.
Sure.
And we had this lovely training environment, and I got so much from it. I went to the national championships. I got third. I should have won, but I had no idea what I was doing. I've never been to a properly banked wooden track before. The track in Brighton is flat. The track in Leicester had 37-degree banking, like completely different thing. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just fast. And he prepared me for that, but not the technical level I needed. I then got picked up by the national team coach, and I won't share his name, the worst coaching experience I've ever had. He was an endurance coach, but he was coaching a sprinter. So he coached me like an endurance athlete.
Sure.
And I'd keep saying, like, why am I not in the gym yet? Or why am I going to do 3-hour bike rides when my longest race is less than a minute? Yeah. And he was like, you've got to be fit and you've got to do this. And I'm like, well, that makes no sense. Like, I need to go fast.
Yeah.
So he didn't understand the sport he was coaching me for and had no ability to discuss it. Like, this is the way. And worse than that, he came back from major races and he said, the Russians, these Germans, the Italians, they're too big, they're too strong. No British athlete will ever win anything. And he's saying this to me when I'm 16 years old. And bearing in mind, I mean, you can't see me, I'm 6'2" and 200 pounds.
Right.
And I was 6'1" and 175 pounds at this time. I was not a small boy for a 16, 17-year-old athlete. And actually, the power figures I was hitting, he didn't even understand it, were world class for my age, but he didn't know that. So the training he was doing was detrimental to my development. And obviously he made me believe that it was pointless. There was no way it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I kind of quit for a bit after that. And then I got introduced to a guy who's now probably my closest friend, a guy called David LeGrice, who became the new national team coach. The best mentor I've ever had, just a wonderful human being. Complete nutcase of a human being, the bravest man I've ever met. Like, you want somebody to do stupid stuff. Hey, Dave, do you want to do this? Yeah, sure, no problem. Addicted to speed and danger, you know, a proper sprinter's guy.
Right.
But what he also had was this massive heart and emotional intelligence to go with it. And that was my first kind of understanding of what that level of coaching was about. You know, not just do as I say, or this, you know, you must do and shout in. He motivated you because he made you want to train harder for him.
Sure.
And for yourself. And he understood how to really get into you, and he knew who to kick up the ass. He knew who to put his arm around them. He understood people with no training for it. Like, he has no degree in psychology or anything like that. He just got people in this most magical way. And that was a great experience for me. And a lot of what I've done as an, you know, as an elite cycling coach and in my work has been inspired by him. So I was incredibly lucky to meet him. And I've said to people, like, I consider him more my father than my father because of what I learned from him.
That's very interesting. You know, I wanted to talk to you today a little bit. And the reason I asked you about your parents and why I asked you about your coaches was because I wanted to approach a subject that I think is so important and so impactful right now in the world of youth sports specifically. And that is that relationship between our coaches and our parents. You know, I had a friend of mine, we went and spoke to a coach that was coaching at the time in the NBA. And he was asking us, what do you guys deal with at the high school level? We were high school coaches. What do you guys deal with? And he's like, I deal with chemistry issues. I deal with this. I deal with contracts. I deal with attitudes. You guys deal with parents. That's one thing that I rarely deal with. And I was like, yeah, that's true. You know, at that level, at that high of a level, if a parent's involved, there's a whole nother set of problems. But at that youth league level, we know that the interaction between parents and that relationship has really changed over the past, I would say, few decades. I know that from my perspective, my parents were a little bit older. I was the youngest of us. But my parents, growing up, they would support my coach. If he told me to do something, they would support it. Even if I disagree with it, they would say, hey, I don't care. We believe in it. And if we were to show any kind of, I'm not sure you should be doing that, I would feed on that and go, well, hey, and kind of drive that wedge in there. But that has changed so much in the past, like I said, few decades. Not only are kids questioning their coaches, that they're kids, that's what they do. The parents have become even more vocal in questioning their coaches. And the kids see this and go, well, if they question them, then I for sure should be questioning them too. Because obviously my parents are seeing something wrong with them. I just feel like that relationship has changed so much in the last few years.
Yeah, I completely agree. And me and Miriam talk about this at Coaches. So it's the job of a coach has changed.
Yes.
The job of a coach has become way more difficult. You know, and you can look at some societal things for this. The role of men has changed, right? The men have become less of the breadwinner, less of the authority. So most coaches are men. So just that's changed in itself. But the bigger thing is the advent of sharing of knowledge. So the coach would be the authority. The coach had all of the answers, all of the knowledge. You, as the parent and the athlete, completely trusted the coach because there was no way to really check whether their information was wrong or right. Right? Now we have this thing called the internet, you know, or even just before, you know, before that, we started to get, you know, sports science and publication of journals around sport and actually investigating it. And when you think about the timeline of sport, that's still actually reasonably new. Sports science, as we were talking about earlier, sport in the UK was amateur until the late 90s. Most of it was amateur. That's 20 years ago. And since then, it's become a profession, and you have professional strength and conditioning coaches. They didn't exist in the 90s and 80s. You just went to the gym and the bodybuilder showed you how to train, right?
That's
so it's
right.
A completely different thing. So now parents and young athletes are armed with so much more information than they've ever been armed with. And they look at sports stars posting their workout videos and they go, well, that guy's doing it. I must do it. That was one of the hardest things for me as a coach, is explaining correct development to parents and to young athletes and even older athletes. You know, I coached masters athletes as well at various points of my career.
Okay.
And explaining to masters athletes, they don't need to be doing the same training that the elite athlete that they follow is posting, because their body is not going to respond the same way. And they can't, you know, as me and you were talking about before, as 50 years old, you can't do what an elite 20-year-old can do, right? You just cannot do it, whether it be the load, whether it be the volume, whether it be the intensity, things change. So yeah, it's a completely changed dynamic to a much more collaborative approach. And that means that coaches need to be more emotionally aware, more emotionally intelligent, and their communication skills have to be much better because it's now a collaboration. It's not an authority.
Absolutely. You know, I've said for a long time, when you're dealing with youth sports specifically, logic goes completely out the window from the side of the parents. When it comes to athletics, you will have, you know, parents, my kid is 5'2 and 87 pounds. They're going pro. And if they don't, it's because you screwed something up. You held them back. You didn't give them, you know, the support they needed. I also understand there can be times that coaches can be bad. They can do a poor job. They may hold kids back. That's happened. We've all seen that. What should parents be looking for in their coaches? My rule of thumb, especially with my kids growing up, I always look for two things. Are they teaching them? Whether that is a technique, whether that is how to work hard, are they teaching them life lessons? Are they teaching them athletic lessons? Because if they're doing those two things, I can probably live with everything else. The other thing at the youth level, are they having some fun? It doesn't have to all be fun, but if they don't like it, they're not going to keep doing it. So I guess those are the big things for me. Is there something that parents should be looking for in their coaches?
Yeah, I love all of that. I'm going to look at it in two different ways. So okay. I think it depends on the age of the athlete.
Good point.
Anything under 14, it should be 100% fun-based. I cannot stress this enough. So many people get this wrong. With the exception of a few sports, and they're the most technical sports, so you're thinking things like gymnastics, tennis, and even that, they still do too much too young. But with the exception of very technical sports, whether you start football at 8 or 14 has no effect on how good you're going to be and whether you're going to get to the NFL. Yeah. Zero.
You're right.
So there's no correlation between those two things. In most sports, you know, especially sports that are more power driven, both sprint sports and endurance sports, it really doesn't matter at what age you start. It just matters what you do once you start.
Yeah.
So there is a negative correlation between somebody being a junior world champion in a sport and then going on to win at a senior and Olympic level. So what I'm saying is you are less likely to be a world and Olympic champion if you've been a junior world champion than if you weren't doing the sport.
Oh, wow.
Which is insane because so many kids get burnt out. We have, you know, so, and this is going to get into the second part of it. So for me, for most sports, under the ages of 13, 14, it should only be fun. They should be doing a variety of sports. And the aim should be you want coaches that are letting the kids enjoy themselves, getting them to understand discipline. Work has results, but again, from a model of fun. Winning should be secondary to the life lessons they're learning. So they're learning discipline, they're learning the results of hard work, they're learning communication, they're learning teamwork, they're learning consequences. So if they turn up late for a practice,
sure,
they don't get to practice, that kind of stuff, but all very evenly keeled. And a coach should never be shouting at an athlete unless right. It's a life or death situation and you need to be loud to be heard.
Safety, yes.
There should never be a need to raise your voice. If you're doing that, for me, you're ineffective. So that's what I would be looking for. I would be looking for a coach that has a very clear culture. And this is where I moved to what I did with my colleague Ben when we did the Olympic development program for USA Cycling. We sat down and we looked at it and we thought, however many athletes, young athletes we have come through this program, if one of them went on to be an Olympian, that's success.
Sure.
Because it's so difficult to go through a development program and end up being an Olympic champion, right? The odds are against you. So we thought, what do we actually want to achieve with this? Well, we do want to raise the level of track cycling in the USA. At the time, it was very low. We wanted to raise it and be more successful. And we want those young athletes to have an experience that leads to them being better human beings. So whatever it is they do at the result of that, whether it be a professional cyclist, whether it be something completely different, they know more about themselves. They've learned more about their own grit and their self-belief and knowing that they can do things and overcome adversity. Yes. They've been exposed to stressful situations in ways that are healthy. so that they can learn, and they've been exposed to adversity in ways that are healthy so that they can learn. And our job was to create better human beings. And exactly the same work I do with leaders in companies, better human beings perform higher.
Absolutely.
You don't need to be a broken human being to perform very well, even though some athletes do go on to great things because of the dysfunctional families and stuff they've come through. You can help them be better as you're doing this journey, and it will not negatively affect the outcome and what they're going to be capable of doing.
You touched on one thing that I did want to ask your opinion on. You're obviously in the coaching business. You deal with athletes, and sometimes you deal with very, very high level of athletes. One thing we see at the youth level, and I know we see it here in the States so much, is we see coaches pushing kids to specialize in one specific sport. If you're going to be a volleyball player, you've got to be volleyball 365 of the year. I couldn't disagree more, but I would love to hear your input on that specifically.
I'm kind of in the middle.
Okay.
And the reason I'm in the middle is because I think it's sport dependent. If you are playing team sports, do as many team sports as you can,
sure,
within a reasonable limit. So, right, you know, you've got to look at it, right? If an athlete's 8 years old and they're playing two team sports, that's a lot of training. So I would only want them doing two or three things a week and being very cognitive of, like, what is the workload we're putting them through? And as they get older, they can up that workload. And you probably do it more seasonal. So you play a sport for this season and a sport for that season so that you keep the load low. And then as they get older, they can take on a bit more workload, as in training load. And then you can be doing multiple sports at the same time. For team sport, all of the data shows that multidiscipline athletes have better outcomes.
Because absolutely,
you're exposing them to more opportunities to find out where their zone of genius is,
yep,
and you're teaching them to be more well-rounded athletes.
For sure.
Where it becomes a little bit more difficult is if you have, like, very sprint and power athletes.
Okay.
Because if you're exposing them to a lot of endurance activities,
yeah,
you're blunting their potential, you're slowing them down.
Sure.
So if they're playing midfield soccer and really they're a 100-meter runner, it's going to make them slower. And sprint sports are already multi-discipline sports because you're also doing weightlifting. So if you're doing a power sport, you're already doing two sports. So I think just being aware of that, you know, as a track cycling coach, so cycling on the whole is 99% endurance. You know, most people, when they think about cycling, the first thing they think about is the Tour de France, one of the greatest endurance feats in sport. Like, it's
sure,
just ridiculous, the requirements of it.
Yeah.
So the majority of cycling is an endurance sport. Track sprinting, which is less than 1% of cycling, is weightlifting on a bike. The training requirements are completely different from endurance sport. So if you want to be good at track sprinting, you don't want to be going and doing road races. You don't want to be doing these longer races,
sure,
because they will absolutely slow you down. But again, you know, that doesn't need to, again, start coming in until they're 14, 15, 16,
yeah,
when both boys and girls have gone through puberty and you're starting to see who the sprinters are and who the endurance athletes are. And then, you know, if they're doing team sports, well, there's still place for sprinters. Soccer players need to be fast. American football players need to be fast. Basketball athletes are incredible sprinters. So
right,
there's place for them in team sport. But if they're doing more of a solo sport, it tends to be you need to differentiate, right? Are they doing too much aerobic volume if they're a sprinter?
Sure, sure. And that makes a ton of sense. And you know, we used to always say with team sports and being involved in team sports, there are those kids out there. They are 100% focused on that one sport. I don't have a problem if that's them. I always hated a parent or a coach, you have to do this year round. It doesn't make any sense. Like you spoke about, become more well-rounded, learn to deal with different people. And I know for me, I played three sports in high school. That's not bragging because I wasn't great at any of them, but I love the change. I love, yeah, when one season would end and you would go to another. That was always so much fun. Lee, I know that, you know, you're coming from across the pond, but now you're here in the States. You're obviously very acclimated to our culture here. We have a very poisonous phenomenon here in athletics, and it's growing stronger and stronger and stronger in America, in the world of youth sports. And that is the sickness of scholarship itis. Parents and kids are locked onto this idea that they can get a collegiate scholarship and go for free. I understand it. College is expensive. And yet sometimes that chase, it leads to bad things for both the kids and the parents. If kids are focused on that from the time they're 5, 6 years old, they burn out by the time they're 10 or 12. And if they don't get it, what, they're a failure? They failed at what they're doing. On the other side, you have the parents. Some of these parents are spending more than the college would have cost to begin with. And then they have the stress and the pressure of pushing their kids. Chasing scholarships can be a very dangerous proposition, can't it?
I think there's three avenues we could go through here. So avenue number one, I want to tie both questions together. So this question and the previous one, while you were speaking, there was something that occurred to me we didn't quite touch on.
Sure.
The kids should be in charge.
Good.
Right? The kids should be in charge of what they do. So you're talking about, I've met young athletes who are, this is my sport, I love it, and this is all I want to do. I'm not going to, just like you, I'm not going to force that kid to do another sport just sure. because it may be beneficial to him, right? You're going to let them do what they want to do. Just the same as I would not make a kid specialize who wanted to do lots of other sports. Unless they get into the national team level and it's like, okay, now you need to make
now
a
you
choice.
Need to focus. So, yeah.
Like, here's a choice, right? You know, you can do three sports, but one of these sports is going to be neglected, or you know, you have potential here to go on to do something great. Do you want to do that? And again, if they say no, keep doing the three sports for fun, right?
Sure.
So I think it's important to recognize the human being should always have the agency, not the parents, not the coach, not the school. And then you're looking at something which I'm talking to men in my kind of men's mental health and well-being world, which is in America, we put too much pressure on university and college degrees. We've got caught into this thing that you're not going to be successful in the world unless you get a university degree.
You're right.
And what we're seeing is that actually there's been a complete switch. So we wanted to empower women. We wanted to get them into STEM sport and STEM schools. We wanted to make women have a better work outcome. And what's happened is now women are outperforming, or women and girls are outperforming boys and men in school and college. And then for men, especially, we're going, well, here's this way for you, you not necessarily academically gifted person, to still go to university, which is you can be a sports star. What we're missing is there should also be trade schools.
Yes.
Especially for men. So that there's not that pressure of you have to go to university, and the way you go to university is to get an academic scholarship or to get a sports scholarship if you're coming from a lower income family. And actually the other avenue is a trade is valuable, and we should be looking at supporting men into going into trade schools, especially men, women obviously too if they want to, but that's where the societal gap is. A bit of an aside, but I think it's interesting to think about how we support young men. And then, yeah, the next thing is this whole thing set up of this incredible pressure on young human beings who haven't got even the brain capacity to handle it. They haven't developed a fully functioning prefrontal cortex to make good and decent decisions. And we're asking them to act like adults who are professional sports people. When you step back and think about it, like, it's utterly insane. It is utterly insane. And that's why so many of these athletes don't make it. And then, you know, why Miriam and my friend Q have businesses supporting athletes transitioning from being, quote unquote, failed college athletes into what do they do next? And we know that even professional athletes, something crazy like 50% of them go broke within 5 years of finishing right. the professional sport, right? Yep. We know that almost all serious athletes have a depressive episode after they quit their sport because they just don't know what to do next because they're not prepared for what to do next.
Right.
And, you know, one of the great things about America is the optimism that we have here. One of the byproducts of that optimism is we sometimes miss the realism. Like, you are unlikely to make it. If you're a high school athlete, you're unlikely to make it to being a college athlete. If you're a college athlete, you are unlikely to make it to being a pro. The chances are stacked against you.
Yes.
Yet we treat everybody as though they're going to make it and they're going to be. It's a bit like, you know, the American dream. Or if you come to America, you're going to be a millionaire. Well, you know what? Very few Americans are millionaires, let alone very few people that are immigrants and come to America, although immigrants actually do better than native-born Americans. So it's a very complex issue. It's beyond my pay grade to figure out the answer. What I will say, though, it is an issue, and it's an issue that we should be taking way more seriously for the emotional and mental well-being of these people that are going through this process.
You bring up some excellent points, and you can say it's above your pay grade, but you're answering the question really, really well. You know, we spoke a little bit about sometimes there are situations where a coach maybe isn't doing what they should be doing. Maybe they aren't teaching the way they should be, or giving these kids the things that they need. Do you have any advice for parents in that situation that feel like maybe they're not getting the most out of their coaches? Do you have any advice to give parents?
Yeah, great question. And a very difficult one.
Yeah.
Because usually I would say you've got to trust your coach.
Right.
You know, as a coach, the worst thing is to have parents constantly coming and telling you how you should do your job differently.
Yes.
Usually with a lack of knowledge and with a massive bias towards their athlete and completely ignoring the welfare of the program and all of the other athletes in the program. And actually, you know, as we've talked about, I coach coaches, the high school and college coaches that I work with, especially the high school coaches. We spend an inordinate time working on their ability to communicate with parents and put boundaries up with parents so they can actually just do their job and they're not managing the drama of parents and parents' emotional, you know, challenges. So what I would say is find the right program. You know, train as a parent to educate the coach to be better. You're unlikely to have the skill set as a parent to be able to give the right advice anyway. You might, but it's going to be challenging.
Sure.
And it's unlikely to be well received by the coach. Find better programs. And then demand from the governing bodies better education for the coaches. So that's where the disconnect is. You know, me and Miriam are finding it challenging, really challenging, to get governing bodies and organizations to buy into what we're doing for coaches. They have very little, if no budget for coach education. And it's insane because sports coaches have a huge impact on emotional well-being and journey of young people. You know, we've talked about it already on this call. I mean, you talked about it just before we jumped on the call, of the impact of those mentors that are coaches in our lives, whether it be positive or negative.
Yep.
And we're letting these people go out there with no training. You know, you don't send a doctor to operate on somebody with no training. They go through 8-9 years of training. And we say to sports coaches, oh, you did the sport? Oh, great. You should be able to coach then.
Good enough.
Completely different skill sets. And your ability to do a sport has almost no relevance to your ability to coach a sport and understand human beings. So I think there's a whole educational piece at the moment that's missing. And we're starting to see some change with that from the point of view, as we mentioned earlier, about sports science, about, you know, strength and conditioning coaching, about conditioning coaches, their careers now. We've got physiologists, we've got strength and conditioning coaches, we've got biologists. So their careers, but we're not looking at the leadership of sports coaches, which is actually the most impactful thing on how well a team does. How does the leader, the coach, bring the team together, create the right culture, and look after their athletes? There isn't anything more impactful on the team than that.
Let's go to the other side. You've got a good coach. You've got that coach that you do really like. What is the best way that parents can support them? Because I have a feeling you're going to tell me it's a little more than make sure you pick them up a gift card at the end of the season and say thank you. That's nice, and I'm not going to turn that down, but there's a lot of ways you can support your coach, isn't there?
I got so few of those, they really stood out when I came.
No, you're right. You're exactly right.
You know, one of my friends describes coaching as mental insanity because the role of a coach is to, especially in lower levels, and professional it's a little bit different, but the role of a coach in more amateur and high school and even college for most sports is to take the full responsibility and get none of the glory.
Yep.
Because the athletes get the glory, the team gets the glory, the coach is usually not mentioned. If the athletes don't perform, the coach gets fired,
not
the athletes. Right. So if you explain that to somebody as a job, right, we want you to work the longest hours with the most pressure of everybody in the position. And most of these, the athletes will get paid more than you'll get paid. And you're going to get the least amount of recognition out of everybody doing this. People would be, why the hell would I do that?
Right.
Coaches are doing that every day. So, yeah, you know, number one, appreciation goes a huge way. I can remember the letters, the phone calls where people appreciate me. You know, I'll give you a bit of a vulnerable share. My time as a US cycling coach, I had a Safe Sport investigation into me. So Safe Sport is a government organization that is put in place to protect athletes. And it turned out to be a kind of like malicious accusation. So what happened was we have a selection criteria for the Junior World Championships. One of the athletes on my program thought they were going to go to the Junior World Championships. They hadn't met the criteria that we thought was necessary for them to go. Okay. Now, I actually didn't make that decision. That's decided by a separate selection committee. I make my recommendation, but the committee makes the decision based on all of the data and the coach's recommendation. Athlete wasn't selected to go. 2 days later, there is an anonymous tip to the Safe Sport investigating panel that I'm a bully, I'm sexist, and I favor certain athletes. With no evidence to go with it. Now, they have to investigate this. They have no choice. Some of the scariest moments of my life, because I'm racking my brain thinking, I don't think I've done these things. But you know what it's like, right?
Yeah.
I don't think I've done these things.
But you go through thousands and thousands and thousands of minutes and time and hours. Done? And yeah.
I'm British, right? My humor is a bit more sarcastic than American humor. Somebody misunderstood me. All of these things you're going through. I spoke to every coach pretty much that I'd done all of the different camps with. And I was like, hey, this thing's going on. Have you seen something? Is there something I need to know? Is there something I need to do differently? Is there something I need to learn? The message I constantly got back was, no, you're great. This is nothing. Don't worry about it. And at this point, I have no idea who's made the complaint. Right. I'm the last person that the investigator calls. So the investigator calls everybody but me, and I'm the last person that they call. And it was actually a really humbling conversation because they'd already made their mind up. You could tell from the way that they're speaking to me, they have all the evidence, they're making a mind up, but they're checking to see where I'm at. They ask me everything. I'm completely honest with them. I get exonerated of everything. And then I get sent a report. I get sent a report, and it's like a testimonial to me as a coach because it's all the kind things that the young athletes and their parents are saying about me, with the exception of one young athlete and one parent. So it's obvious, obviously, what happened. And until I get that report, I had no idea who and why and whatever. And it was a disgruntled athlete who didn't get to go to Junior World Championship.
Sure.
And this happened, right?
Yes.
And that's, and the reason I share this is because, one, it's incredibly scary and a horrible process to go through. And two, this is what coaches face that parents don't necessarily understand. These are the pressures that coaches are under that parents don't understand. So what I ask for parents is some recognition of that, right? Some humility. Coaches are doing the best they can. Whether they're a good coach or a bad coach, very few people are inherently evil. So they're doing the best they can with the toolbox that they have. Some toolboxes are bigger than others. Back to my point about you want to get better coaches, support the organization and demand better education for coaches and better support for coaches. Get people like me to come and do talks to your coaches and support your coaches. And then your role as a parent is to be there for your athlete. You know, you can give feedback to the coach. So I would partner with parents and they would say, you know, I'm concerned about this and this. And I would always approach them as a human being. And I would see them and think they want the best for their kid. And my job is to train them as a coach as to what their role is, where it starts and stops, and to help protect their kid in some instances from their parents' misplaced desires.
Yes.
You know, we've all seen the parents that are, as you said, Johnny's 8 years old. I think he's going to go to the Olympics. I've never met an eight-year-old that I know for sure is going to go to the Olympics. No. I've met lots of eight-year-olds whose parents are convinced they're going to go to the Olympics.
Yes.
Right? And I can't remember many of them that continue doing the sport because they get burnt out, right? Because they can't live up to their parents' expectations. You know, we see the stories of Serena and Venus Williams. We see the stories of Tiger Woods. And we think that's the model. And actually, they are the 1 in 100 million exceptions. You've got 999 million other athletes that stopped doing the sport and were burnt out and now are emotionally damaged from that experience.
Yes.
What would we rather have? you know, that's not the model necessarily to get to the top. There's many ways. So, yeah, I think it's that education piece. And it's also that boundary of, so what I used to do is empower the athletes to put the boundary in place. So we would have a culture conversation at the beginning of each year, and we would write a code of conduct, and I would lead the meeting, but the athletes would lead that part of the meeting where they wrote their own code of conduct. They'd have some input from me, like, right, here's some things we're missing. Maybe we don't need to be, you know, they're always harder on themselves than you need to be on them. Right. So usually dial it back. Okay, I think that punishment might be a little bit severe for that crime here, okay? And I never needed to enforce it. They would enforce it amongst themselves. Somebody turned up late for a session, the other children or the other young athletes would say, you can't train today.
Right.
I don't need to enforce that, right? You know, you don't clear your table, your plate up after a meal. The other kids would say, right, you're bussing the tables for the next meal. They would call each other out on it. So I didn't even need to be, I could be the big parent dog and step in and do that, but I very rarely needed to.
Right.
And part of that was, what did they want from their parents? And we'd be very clear about that. So every single group I've ever done this with, so how track cycling works is you go to an event, you have an infield pit. Everybody's in that pit together. That is our corral. That's our area where we warm up, we get ready, and you go from there to the start line on the actual track itself.
Okay.
Every single group I've ever worked with, the number one rule is no parents on the infield.
Yeah.
The parents turn up, they drop their kids off, they bring their stuff in for them, they go stand in the stand.
Yes.
That's it. Same thing. I haven't yet had a kid who is like, I want my parents shouting advice to me from the stand while I'm racing.
Right.
I'm trackside, or one of the other coaches is trackside. We are the only people communicating with that athlete in the race. They can shout, go, Johnny. Good job, Johnny. No tactical advice. That comes from us. Now, you know, being a bit cocky, I haven't met a coach a parent who understood the sport more than me.
Sure.
So it's quite easy for me to demonstrate my knowledge and say, like, I've got this, you're in safe hands.
Even so, it's confusing to the athlete when the coach and the parent are both yelling. Yeah. You know, it's horrible.
Yeah. You know, either you've got to trust in what the coach is doing,
yeah,
or you give you know, giving world-class feedback. So giving feedback, you've got to choose your moment and time. And that comes for parents too. So approaching the coach in front of the kids and trying to give feedback, massive no.
Yeah.
You want to speak to the coach, you arrange your time, you do that privately and you speak to the coach. You never do that in front of the athlete because you're undermining that coach's ability to deal with the athlete. And as you said, if the parents are saying you're doing it wrong and then the kid starts questioning it too, now you've lost that continuity that you need as a coach for them to trust you and to buy into what you're doing. And if the coach is genuinely not doing it right, find a different coach.
Yeah.
You know, there are times when coaches are not doing it right, when they're not skilled enough, when they're not good actors, they're doing inappropriate things. Get your kid out of there. Yeah. Don't keep your kid in a bad program. And the other thing, and this is, I've come across this so much in my coaching career, mm-hmm, is coaches that can't let go. So I would see this. I'm terrible with non-high performance athletes. I'm just rubbish at it. You know, if you've got a group of 8 to 12-year-old kids, you want to give them a velodrome experience, I can do it, but they're going to enjoy it less with me than they will do with somebody else. Because I'm going to be like, you know, look at your bike position. Let me sort that out for you. Like, you've got to bend your arms more and you've got to get in this position. These kids just need to ride their bikes. They don't need to be doing high performance minutiae things. That's how my brain works. You need somebody who's creating this massive get on there, have a go atmosphere. And there's people way better at that than I am, like much better. However, when it comes to the next stage, when we are now talking high performance and we're now really getting into the minutiae of how we do these things, that's where I excel. And some coaches can't let their athletes go. You know, whether it be ego, whether it be protection, they get to that point when they're 14, 15 usually, and they need to go to the next level. They need to go to a more challenging program. Sure. They need to go to a more challenging, more technical coach. And, you know, any coach listening to this, know what your role is. I never worked with development, like young development, beginner athletes, because I'm rubbish at it. So why would I do that? Why would I do that to the athletes? Why would I do that to myself? I did it for free at one velodrome for a short period of time because there was no one else to do it. And it just re-highlighted to me how bad I was at it. It's like, I'm not the guy for that. When it comes to developing athletes from being, you know, talented to world level, I love that. That's my zone of genius. That's where you come and work with me. And knowing as a coach, where do you fit in that? Are you somebody that's working with the very, very cream? Because if you are, you're probably already doing it. If you're not, and you're mainly working with those fun, experiential athletes, stop trying to hang on to the really talented ones because right. you are doing them a disservice. Help them find the next person in their ladder and be part of the process, not a hindrance to the process.
That is such good advice and great advice just in general for coaches. Always, always, always know yourself, know your athletes, know your own team. Forget the scouting, forget that stuff. Until you know those things, you're kind of wasting your time because you could do a lot of introspective. Okay, what do I do well? What do I not do well? What do I need to get better at? What does my team need to before you ever worry about who's on the other sideline? That is very, very good advice. Lee, you have this company that is in the business of helping coaches. I have to imagine coaches come to you, and one of the biggest problems is what we've been talking about today. I've got a problem parent. I've got a problem group of parents. It might be 10 parents, whatever it might be. What do you tell them? What are some of the methods that you give these coaches? Here are some ways to kind of head these off. I know you spoke a little bit, those preseason meetings. Those are huge. Those are huge. To establish boundaries, to establish how we do things and the culture of what we do, that is so important. Are there other things out there that you say, hey, you've got to make sure you're doing this?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the sport. It depends on the age because there's difference, obviously, between them. As a general rule, with those kind of older, young adults, I get them to drive it. I get them to drive the culture. I get them to talk to their parents.
Sure.
And, you know, like you said with, you know, coach said, I've got to do this. Nothing more powerful for me than a kid saying to the parent, I can't do that because this is what my coach has told me I need to do.
Yeah.
And the parent's like, okay.
Yeah.
And the parent won't argue with the kid because the kid is going to argue with them like tooth and nail, especially at their age, that age where they're differentiating themselves from their parents and the parent is no longer the hero. And actually, I had empathy and compassion for parents in that because the kids have been, they're being stroppy little brats at that point, right? Where they're like setting their own boundaries and they're exploring that. And they're like, no, mum and dad, you know nothing. You're dumb. And they're trying to set their own boundaries here. And I would have compassion with the parents and make time to just help them understand what was going on and explain things to them as partners. I would let those kids drive that, right? The kids set the boundaries there.
Yeah.
When you're talking kind of larger teams and team sports, I recommend things like office hours. So instead of parents being able to text you and ring you night and day, Fridays at 4 o'clock, I'm available. Come into my office from 4 to 5 o'clock and we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. Anything outside of that, unless it's an emergency or a health issue, I'm not available to talk about it. So that there's clear definitions about what is expected and when these parents can come and talk to you. A couple of benefits to that, right? One, when are parents most likely to talk to you? Well, when their kid's just been cut from a game or when they've had a bad game, you know, when they're at their most emotional. Last moment you want to talk to them. So you have some kind of set time that's going to allow them to calm down, collect themselves a bit. They may not even come and talk to you about it, right? They might emotionally regulate themselves and do that. And also it makes it be more thoughtful. What are they actually coming to you? It's a meeting now. It's not a like ad hoc conversation. It's a meeting. What are you actually coming to bring to the meeting that you want to talk about? And, you know, I've worked with coaches. A lot of coaches are people pleasers. A lot of coaches, like, they like people. That's why they do the job.
Sure.
And they really struggle with that boundary part of it. Yet it's so vital to them for their own health. Because they're getting texts from, you know, parents at 11 o'clock at night, even if they don't respond to it, it's still agitating them.
It's
and
winding
them up. And they're like, what's going on? So I think just being really clear on those boundaries of when I'm available, when I'm not. I'm not available to speak to you during a match. Like, that's a huge no. I may be available after the match, but only if we've agreed on that, right? You come up to me after a match and start talking. No. I'm not talking to you right now. Yep. Here's my office hours. We'll talk about it there. And allowing coaches to know that that's actually okay. And that's not you being rude. And that's not you letting this parent down. It's okay to have these boundaries so that you're protected and that you protect those young athletes. I've had coaches that have been assaulted at matches or been threatened at matches. And, you know, they're saying to me, well, I'm a bit concerned about asking the school to get this parent removed because I'm wondering, but, you know, worried about what it might do. I'm like, no, that person never turns up to a game again. Absolutely not. Your safety is the number one most important thing.
Yes.
You cannot do your job if you are not safe, right? And we absolutely don't want young athletes to see parents being
physically
right? That's a huge no. So, you know, a lot of what I do as a leadership coach is I give people permission to do the right things.
Yeah.
Because they feel they're telling themselves a story. I'm a bad coach if I'm not there for everybody all the time. Well, that's just completely unrealistic. You cannot be there. You can't do that. So it's helping them create those really healthy boundaries about what is appropriate and what's not appropriate, and then some accountability to help them stick to it. Because, you know, when we look at coaches, loads of coaches don't look after themselves.
You're right.
Right? They're overweight. They're drinking too much because that's how they cope, especially men. So
yes.
How do men cope with stress? They drink and they eat. So, you know, we're not looking after the whole health of the coach. And then how can that coach stand up and look after somebody else? And I'm not saying you need to be an athlete, right? You do not, right? I'm not saying, you can be, you know, you don't need to be, you know, ripped and in great athletic shape. But what you do need to be doing is looking after yourself. So you want to be doing some moderate exercise. You want to be making sure you're eating good quality food. You're getting especially decent quality sleep. Because otherwise, how do you show up as a support network for others if you're not supporting yourself?
Excellent answers, Lee. I could sit here and talk coaching with you all day. You are one of the co-founders of Coaches Soul, like I said, a platform that is looking to help coaches with some of these exact situations. Hey, I'm telling you right now, if you are a coach and you're dealing with difficult parents, maybe you're dealing with difficult players or difficult administrators, even if you're a manager, you're having a tough time connecting with your employees, you need to reach out and contact Coaches Soul. Get the help that not only you need, that you owe to yourself, because like Lee said, so many times, it is just about giving you permission to do what is best for you and for your program and for your company and for your team. Lee, tell us again, how can people find you? What kind of available plans do you have for coaches and leaders?
One little last thing before I do that. There's a lot of shame for coaches about asking for help.
You're right.
So, you know, we ask, and athletes feel this too. It's been an issue for athletes' mental wellness as well. I'm not tough enough. I'm a pussy if I ask for help. And asking for help and support, I have a coach. In fact, I have two. I have a coach for me and my emotional well-being, and I have a coach who coaches my coaching. So I video my coaching calls, and that coach gives me critique and feedback on how I coach other people. So asking for support is well-known in the business world, still not hit in the coaching world yet. It doesn't make you weak. I work with Olympic-level coaches. And actually, the higher the level of the coach, the more they understand how vital this is.
Yeah.
And that's how they've got there, because they have lots of mentors and support in their life. So I just want to reiterate, it's not weak to ask for it. You don't need to be broken. You don't even need to necessarily be facing big distress. Yeah. You just want to work out how to do this better and be better at what you do. That's what we're here to help you do. And then, coachessoul.com, contact me there. Lee@coachessoul.com to email me, come and chat. Every initial conversation is free. I'll give you as much time as you need to understand what it is we do and why you might want to work with us. And I've worked with coaches that have coached multiple gold medal winning athletes, teams that are creating, you know, state winning championship culture. Miriam is a two-time Olympian, former head of synchro swimming for USA, CEO of it. We've been there. We know what it's all about. We understand it. You don't need to do this alone. It doesn't make you better, tougher, smarter to do it by yourself. Yeah. And it's so funny, isn't it? Because this is how lots of coaches feel. Yeah, if we put that onto them, do the athletes do it by themselves? Do we just expect athletes to do it? Roger Federer, greatest tennis player with Serena Williams that has ever lived, had a coach his entire career.
Well, and we would tell kids, you wouldn't try to do it by yourself. There's no way. You'll never succeed doing it by yourself. It is okay to take that help and to allow your teammates, which is what Coach Assol is going to be for you, a teammate for you to support you and help you. You know, I think back to even when I was coaching, some of the things you're saying were so completely applicable to what I went through and what you're dealing with on a day-to-day, the stress levels, taking care of yourself, setting boundaries. These are things that are so monumentally important. I would encourage you, go out, check out Coach Assol, get in touch with Lee because he is going to help you so, so much. Lee, I cannot thank you enough for your time today. I genuinely appreciate it. And you have to know, you are welcome to come back anytime. I would be glad to sit down and have another conversation anytime. Let's keep this relationship going.
I'd love to. We need to talk basketball.
Yeah, we
can
do that.
I'm a huge basketball fan. I'm a Warriors fan, complete sure. Bay Area bandwagon because when I first moved here, I lived in San Jose for 4 years.
Okay.
Steph Curry is my basketball god. So yeah, we can definitely talk basketball.
Where are you at now? Where is it that
Long
you live
Beach.
Now? You're in Long Beach. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, what a beautiful area. Absolutely gorgeous area.
And I can't be a Lakers fan.
Thank you.
Just can't do it.
Thank you. Lee, I just fell a little bit in love with you. I appreciate that right there. Because you know, with me being a Nuggets fan, I can't tolerate those doggone Lakers either. So let's do this again. I cannot thank
love
you
to.
Enough. You know that you are welcome anytime.
Thank you, buddy.
Hey, next week on The Dose, I am chasing a very special guest to try to get his thoughts on the NFL playoffs. And trust me on this, he has a ton of insight. You do not want to miss this. So be sure you stop by The Daily Dose and be sure you let a friend know to do the same. Hey, I want to say thank you so much to Lee Puvey for stopping by and sharing some very good information for both coaches and parents today. I really enjoyed our conversation. And I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to The Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the texts. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out the new things going up there every week. But more than anything, thank you for sharing the podcast, for sharing the video, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. We absolutely love when you do that. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.
Not two, not three, not four, not five.